this in a way is a very powerful metaphor that tells us that the current economic model that we have is almost at war with the safeguard of the environment. So in other words, we need to think about an economic model that would help us to keep greenhouse gas emissions at bay. And the Paris Agreement, to a large extent, is very much about this, because it was a historical coup, it was a political coup, it was a scientific coup. In many ways, it was a coup, in the sense that it has taken over 20 years, two decades at least, to arrive at that agreement, and to have a consensus in terms of what this economic model could look like. This new sort of way of working in terms of climate action, whereby we are saying that it's very important that we move away from economies that have been so fixated on fossil fuel to cleaner technologies that would, in many ways, we hope, enable us to grow, but to grow and to grow in ways that will not mean that we are putting the planet at risk or putting the planet under much pressure. The aspirations of the Paris Agreement to a large extent is a little bit also, it sits at somewhat of a paradox in many ways with the industrial aspirations of many of the emerging economies, because we know that when you look at China and India, these are countries that would want to also industrialize. But we are basically saying that we shouldn't adopt a model, a growth model, whereby we industrialize and then we clean up later. And now we have to think about a strategy that allows us to be a little bit smarter in terms of how we're going to grow. In many ways, again, I think what we need is to have, again, a new type of economic model, but we also need to think in very radical ways. So there are several things we need to do differently in terms of our thinking, but also in terms of the climate action that we need to put in place. And I think there's been figures that have been bandied about in terms of our current stock of carbon in the atmosphere, whether this is 350 parts per million in terms of carbon in the atmosphere, or whether it's 400 parts per million, we are, basically well, outside our means in terms of our carbon budget. And therefore, we have to think about, again, as I said, a new way of development, and one that doesn't endanger the planet any further. So what did the Paris Agreement do? I think to a large extent, the agreement in itself provided a sense of direction. There was a direction of travel in terms of how we as a society can begin to address climate change. It didn't provide a formula as such, but it provided a direction of travel. And I think to a large extent, we came out of the agreement with at least things that were quite clear. We were now going to move from a stalemate to a very ambitious global vision. And we were also going to now try to see how we could turn the agreement from one of reckless consumption to one whereby we're moving to a safe growth, as I mentioned. And again, we were also going to look into our own arsenal of the renewable energy potential, which we know that the prices of renewable have been coming down for a while. So we're going to look into that to basically see how we can use renewable energies in many ways to expand and to generate jobs. And also, basically, that the carbon sectors that are the sectors that we consider as high carbon sectors are sectors that are now going to contract. So in many ways, this was what we were trying to do in Paris. there's at least three things that I'd like to mention in terms of the consensus from Paris. The first one is the very important fact that we are going to keep global warming at well below 2 degrees Celsius, which I think is very important. But I think beyond that, there's also this expression that many of you would have had, this aspect of ratcheting up ambition, that we are also going to pursue efforts that would mean that we can further limit the increase in temperature to 1.5 degrees Celsius. So this was also very important. But I think more than that, the Paris Agreement is very much about, you know, not countries waiting for the other to act. It's about everybody has an equal stake in terms of the action. So it meant that this was going to now enable all countries to put forward their own targets. So that's another third important point, that from now on, it's, you know, the onus is on every country, every party to begin to sort of put forward their own targets. And I think the strategy for doing this is presented in the nationally determined contributions, that all countries have to present their nationally determined contributions and also be able to say where and how they're going to be able to reduce emissions. So what this meant, what this means for Africa, I think, is what James and Johnson will be talking to us about today, so that we get a better sense of where does Africa sit within this global debate. We know that many African countries have formulated very ambitious NDCs. Their national determined contributions are quite ambitious. Do they have the means? Are the means of implementation in place that would allow them to be able to live up to these expectations or these ambitions or aspirations? Can they also somehow move away from, you know, our carbon footprint is relatively marginal compared to other regions, but can we now begin to grow in a sort of carbon smart way, if I can put it that way? Can we move away from dirty fossil fuels? And what does that mean in terms of our own model of growth and our own right for development or survival, as some might say? So don't want to take up much time in terms of framing. I think I've said enough. Our colleague James Morabetti is the officer in charge at the African Climate Policy Center, and he is going to be presenting on this important issue in terms of what are the implications for withdrawal, the US implications for withdrawal. We're also going to be hearing from Johnson Kemp, a senior climate adaptation expert as well from the ACPC, who is also going to act as a discussant. James, over to you. There are plenty of things that I didn't mention in terms of what this might mean for Africa, but I'm sure you're going to give us a deeper sort of analysis in terms of what are we looking at, what are the implications for Africa. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Fatima, for that detailed introduction. Now, good afternoon, colleagues. First, I would like to actually start by showing a map of the status of the Paris Agreement. I want to start my discussion from the point where Fatima started here, which is to recognize that climate change is, in fact, to a large extent, the product of a hegemonic economic system, which is based on almost unbridled expansion of consumption and production, which is informed also by a process of commodification of just about everything. Now, I use hegemony in the sense that Franz Fanon, for instance, uses hegemonic, which is to recognize that the system could be near hegemonic, but there are also many things that are happening outside of that system, many recognitions that the system itself is dysfunctional, and therefore many experiments to actually develop alternative approaches to how we construct our livelihoods, that is, alternative approaches to economic systems, alternative economic models. So this map shows the countries that were party to the Paris Agreement at the beginning of the year. And as you can see, just about every country in the world, except the USA, Syria, and Nicaragua, we had already either signed or ratified the Paris Agreement. I understand that of late Nicaragua has actually also signed the agreement. So what this means is that there are in fact only two countries that have not ratified or signed the Paris Agreement. You can understand possibly the contemporary reasons why Syria has not signed the agreement. And therefore our task today is firstly to trace the reasons why the United States has stated its intention to withdraw from the agreement, as well as the implications of that agreement for Africa. Again, implications understood in the sense of the development of African economies in a climate-constrained context. Let me also preface my discussion by recognizing that we can actually conclude that the United States, in fact, has never been party to the climate agreement since the UNFCCC Kyoto Protocol. You will recall that when the United States, in fact, refused to ratify the Kyoto Protocol in 1997, that was the beginning of the demise of the Kyoto Protocol. So, in fact, climate governance globally has tended to proceed without the participation of the United States, or with the partial participation of the United States, for reasons that will also become clear, I think, during my presentation. So, with that preface, let us first of all understand why it is necessary for every nation to be involved in the governance of the climate response. It is significant that we must recognize that the atmosphere is a commons. In other words, the atmosphere cannot be divided on the basis of territory, ownership, or whatever. Everyone in an ideal situation has got equal access to the atmosphere. If it is a commons, then what we know from common property theory is that there are several components that are required in order to meet the conditions necessary for successful governance of a commons. Of these conditions, the three key conditions are that any commons governance system should contain elements of cooperation, predictability, and reciprocity among all of the affected parties. In the case of climate, this means among all of these three elements must in fact obtain among all of humanity. Reciprocity is particularly important because it entails that for anyone to participate in commons governance, there has to be a reasonable expectation that other parties are going to reciprocate, are going to behave in a similar manner. And we also know from common property theory that any non-cooperation or non-reciprocation tends to result in the tragedy of the commons, the old Garrett Hardin's theory of the tragedy of the commons. And the implication is that the quality of the commons tends to decline with in direct correlation to the amount of non-cooperation or non-reciprocation. Now, the Paris Agreement itself recognizes all of this. It recognizes that the atmosphere is a global commons, and that therefore there is a need for everyone, all of the parties, to participate, which is why it has been celebrated as a massive achievement in multilateralism. However, a key component of the Paris Agreement is that it also puts in place mechanisms that would ensure that firstly, you can predict how parties are going to behave as they implement the agreement. These are the commitments that individual countries made to the Paris Agreement, which Fatima referred to. The Paris Agreement also attempts to put in place mechanisms for cooperation. That is the ratchet up mechanism, which seeks to ensure that progressively parties will become more and more responsible, and that there will be a collective mechanism by which we understand what each individual is doing in contribution to the achievement of the agreement. And reciprocity, of course, is implied in signature and belonging to the agreement. The main principle that is applied in the Paris Agreement is this principle of enlightened self-interest. That is to say that the agreement recognizes that nations would continue to pursue their own self-interest insofar as the achievement of their own goals contributes towards the achievement of global goals regarding the outcomes of climate change. And that therefore individual countries will stop pursuing their individual self-interest if they recognize that that pursuit would result in negative consequences for the global climate, right? That is the principle that is undergirded Paris Agreement. This is significantly different from the Kyoto Protocol, which was premised on the principle of common but differentiated responsibility. The Kyoto Principle basically recognized that countries have contributed in different amounts to carbon concentrations in the atmosphere, and that countries should take responsibility for those contributions that they had made. Paris basically simply says that, well, everyone is interested in controlling climate change, and that therefore it is in the interest of everyone to become party to the agreement. Now, as we know, the US withdrawal from the agreement already begins to contradict that fundamental principle of the agreement. In terms of the agreement itself, if we can go to the next slide, Charles. We know that the principal aim is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions at the 2 degrees, a goal that Fatima discussed in her introduction. And we also know that the main mechanism by which this is going to be achieved is actually based on developing the pathways towards low carbon emissions. In other words, shifting energy systems in all sectors of economic activity away from fossil fuels to greener and more efficient energy systems. The achievement of this alteration, this shift in the development pathway, is also going to entail significant amounts of investment, both public and private. All of these are issues that are actually affected by the US's intended withdrawal from the agreement. If you go to the next slide, Charles. All countries have made different commitments to the agreement, as we know. And the US commitments in this particular case are very important, firstly because the US is among the top two emitters of greenhouse gases with China. And of course, we understand that this classification has to be understood in historical context. China only becomes a significant contributor in the last few decades, while the US has been a leading emitter for several for a century plus some decades. But the US has also been a major contributor to financing the global climate response. As we said, achieving greener development pathways depends on a significant amount of investment. And the US has been the major contributor. As part of its Paris Agreement commitment, the US actually pledged $3 billion per annum to the Green Climate Fund. And of course, the US is also a leader in technological innovation across the globe. So withdrawal by the US entails firstly potential impacts of continued US greenhouse gas emissions on the global environment, but also withdrawal of US financial and technological support for climate actions. So the next slide basically just shows the carbon dioxide emissions from the top emitting countries. The USA, as you can see in gray there, is consistently the top emitter, emitting somewhere close to 1.5 million tons of carbon dioxide annually. China is increasing exponentially and overtakes the US as an emitter in between 2007 and 2008. Everyone else is more or less much way below those two countries. In the next slide, we are showing the US emissions commitment to the Paris Agreement. As you know, the Paris Agreement contains the pre-2020 actions and the post-2020 actions. The reason being that, in fact, when the agreement came into force, the expectation was that it would come into force in 2020. So pre-2020, the expectation was that the USA would have reduced its emissions by 17% by 2020, increasing to between 26 and 28% below 2005 levels by 2025. 2005 is the baseline that has been used by the USA in its nationally determined contribution. And this is a significant fact. We'll come back to discuss the implication of that 2005 baseline. The next slide basically discusses the strengths and weaknesses of the Paris Agreement. We have heard already that the agreement has got a strength in that it allows for countries to adjust their emissions targets relative to the actions of other countries. Remember the self-interest principle. I.e., as countries recognize that some countries are making significant contributions to the global climate governance framework, they would also increase their contributions. And this is done also through the ratchet up mechanism by which countries can assess their performance and put in place mechanisms to heighten their ambitions. The Paris Agreement also allows for countries to negotiate agreements outside of that framework as well. So for instance, two countries can agree that there are in fact transboundary impacts of climate change between, let's say, a river basin, a shared river basin, and come to an agreement about how to manage that. Similarly, this can happen to other ecosystems and so on. There are many possibilities for countries to agree to different arrangements outside of the agreement. And this does not entail the renegotiation of the entire Paris Agreement itself. So in the long term, the Paris Agreement is structured in such a way that it becomes an incremental agreement. It is based on an assumption that ambition can in fact be incrementally increased based on our experience with its implications. But the agreement has got several significant weaknesses. In fact, at the signing of the agreement, it was recognized that one of the reasons why almost all nations agreed to signing the agreement when they agreed was because the agreement is particularly flexible. It is a weak agreement. And some of the weaknesses include, to begin with, there are no emissions targets that are set for anyone. All emissions targets of the Paris Agreement are voluntary and they are self-determined. Secondly, the agreement itself, because it is completely voluntary, does not have any enforcement mechanism. In other words, even if a country submits its nationally determined contributions, there is no global mechanism to hold that country accountable for the achievement of the targets set in those nationally determined contributions. And there's also no provision for sanctions to be imposed on non-complying countries. And the third key weakness of the agreement is that the agreement is not binding. This is to say that there is no requirement in the Paris Agreement that it should be domesticated in national legislation. Again, this is significant because we can in fact have NDCs that are statements of intent, but that are not linked to any national policy or legislative processes which which countries or which require different sectors in different countries to actually abide by the commitments that are made in those NDCs. So there are several key questions then that arise out of the firstly the structure of the agreement as well as the intended USA withdrawal from the agreement itself. The first, and it's an obvious question, is that can a country, a nation that is historically responsible for a significant proportion of the carbon concentrations in the atmosphere for several decades, be allowed to simply walk away from its responsibilities? Or stated differently, because we have said that the Paris Agreement is based on this principle of enlightened self-interest, so if the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities is no longer the principle guiding the global climate governance framework, can such a framework be expected to be capable of resolving the climate challenge? In other words, is the Paris Agreement structured in a way that it can actually guide the behavior, not only of the USA, but of all nations, towards the achievement of the goals of that Paris Agreement? or to put it differently, can we achieve the 2 degrees or less than 2 degrees objective in the context of the Paris Agreement? And if not, what can be done by the rest of the humanity? So to understand these questions, and to also understand the implications of the withdrawal on Africa, I think we need to understand why the USA is withdrawing from the Paris Agreement. The agreement, this should be almost self-evident, the withdrawal from the agreement is informed in part by the ability of very powerful private sector interests to lobby and affect public policy in the USA. And in particular, the particular section of this private interest is the fossil fuel lobby, which is quite a powerful and significant lobby, which is seeking actually to increase its profitability rather than to reduce its profitability even in the Paris Agreement era. And I'm going to explore a little bit the ways by which this is happening. Secondly, we also know from the whole sort of electoral process in the USA that the Trump administration undertook already to roll back what they labeled as job-destroying environmental regulations and to save fossil fuel jobs. In fact, one of the first executive orders that was signed by the U.S. presidency was the revision of the Clean Air Act, which was the principal mechanism, legal and policy mechanism, by which the USA regulated the functioning of the fossil fuel industry in relation to pollution. We also know that despite all of the global efforts in the Kyoto Protocol and now in the Paris Agreement era, there are significant impacts, significant influences that are being exerted by the fossil fuel interests in many countries beyond the USA itself, particularly in developed countries, but also expressed in developing countries. Again, we'll demonstrate how this is currently occurring. And finally, it is quite clear that the USA has great difficulty in crafting public policy in order to control private interests, particularly in climate change. In other words, public policy in the USA actually tends to reflect the interests of private interests, of private investors rather than the interests of the public. And again, I think that this means that we really need to begin to engage with the implications of the private sector influence on public policy in a more nuanced way than we have hitherto attempted. Currently, we hear that, for instance, there is a need to develop a public-private partnerships in very unsophisticated ways, which assume that the interests of the public, of the private sector, are in fact going to coincide with public interest. So, I did say that we need to understand the 2005 baseline and the implications of that for our emissions reductions. If you look at the Paris emission goals for the USA relative to its baseline in 2005, the USA was actually going to contribute a significantly larger amount of emissions reductions than any other country globally, while developing countries, particularly India, in fact didn't commit to this reduction until about 2030. In other words, several developing countries already recognize that they need to maintain or to even increase their carbon emissions in order to achieve their development objectives. And recall that this was part of the Trump administration's justification of their withdrawal, that this agreement is unfair to the United States. It requires the United States to invest in cutting carbon emissions while everyone else is increasing emissions. So public policy versus market mechanisms. The Paris Agreement, we have to understand, is that in fact it places the responsibility for the transition to low carbon economies squarely in the sphere of public policy. This is significantly different from the Kyoto Protocol, which, as you will recall, was based on market mechanisms to achieve climate objectives. The key principal objectives, I mean mechanisms of the Kyoto Protocol, were the Clean Development Mechanism and REDD+. Both of them, in fact, are based on the ability of forests. I mean, the REDD+ is based on the ability of forests to sequester carbon and the ability of nations to trade in the carbon that was sequestered in the forest, right? While the Clean Development Mechanism allows for emitting countries to emit as long as they can buy credits from non-emitting countries. Both of them are market mechanisms. So the difference then is that the Paris Agreement moves away from the market and assumes or undertakes to ensure that public policy processes through the NDCs become responsible for regulating the carbon emissions for the different countries. Now, we can also see, if we look at how the Kyoto Protocol performed in the next slide, that there is no significant difference between the emissions of the USA, which ratified the Kyoto Protocol, and the emissions, which did not ratify the protocol, and the emissions of countries which actually ratified the protocol, except for Australia, which, as you will recall, Australia actually withdrew from the protocol at a later stage, but initially ratified. So what this graph is demonstrating is that, in fact, the market mechanisms of the Kyoto Protocol did not significantly impact on the rate of carbon emissions. So market mechanisms were a failure. And one would assume that, therefore, the shift from the market to public policy in the Paris Agreement was informed by the failures of the Kyoto Protocol. Although we could also argue that this may not necessarily be the case. Now, I said that the US decision to withdraw was actually informed by fossil fuel interests. Let us explore what these interests are, or rather, how these interests express themselves. Firstly, we know that the US has actually become the world's largest producer of oil and gas. It is also the largest consumer of oil and gas. This has been driven particularly by developments in technology, fracking in particular, which has made it possible to access oil and gas reserves that were previously inaccessible. These investments, particularly in fracking, are also supported by quite generous national subsidies. And these subsidies are actually occurring at both the federal and state levels. And we also know that there are also significant offshore explorations, particularly in the Alaskan Arctic waters of the USA. With regards to our coal, we probably have a reverse trend occurring, so that coal production is declining at a significant rate in the USA. So for instance, in 2010, the market capitalization of the top four US coal producing countries was $22 billion. By 2015, this has declined to $1.2 billion. So this is because the coal-fired power is being crowded out by natural gas, because natural gas is increasing due to fracking and other investments. But there are also some investments in renewable energy, although to a lesser degree than in oil and natural gas. So we also know that prior to this current U.S. administration, there was a significant closure of existing coal-fired power plants, largely due to national advocacy efforts, but significantly also due to the economic implications of gas compared to coal. Now, looking at the support for fossil fuels in the USA, in the next slide. Firstly, we have already said that gas has been made available and cheaper because of fracking. But we also know that support for fossil fuels has been a consistent feature of successive U.S. administrations. In other words, the support that is being provided to fracking and so on did not start with the Trump administration. Did not even start with the Obama administration. It is a long-term feature of the U.S. Economic process. And in many ways, it is a reflection of the long-term enduring effect of fossil fuel interest on the policy-making process in the USA. A significant mechanism by which fossil fuels are continuing to dominate the policy arena is actually through subsidies. In developing countries, subsidies tend to be experienced in the sense that fossil fuels are actually exported to developing countries at rates that are probably less than investment in renewable energy. However, in developed countries, we know that fossil fuel subsidies have been increasing even in the post-Paris Agreement, and this is not in the USA alone, in all developing countries. And they have several inefficient impacts, such as encouraging wasteful consumption of fossil fuels, distortions of energy markets, all of the negative impacts of subsidies. If we look in the next slide at the average annual national subsidies for fossil fuel production, just for the 2013 and 2014 years in millions of dollars, you'll see that in those 2 years, the USA was subsidizing fossil fuels at a rate of around $20 billion per year, while other developed countries, including the UK, France, Germany, were subsidizing, but at significantly lower rates. But it is also, I think, interesting to note that in the BRICS, there were also significant investments in fossil fuel subsidies, led by Russia, which was subsidizing at a higher rate than the USA. So 2013-2014, fossil fuel subsidies for Russia, which were mostly for oil, gas, including subsidies for power plants, oil and gas pipelines and refining, but also for coal mining, amounted to $22 billion per year. The point that I'm making here is that in fact all developing economies, because remember the BRICS economies are also developing and probably developing faster, all developing economies are also economies that are investing significantly in fossil fuels rather than reducing their fossil fuel investments. So this graph is before the 2015 Paris Agreement, but you also know that post-2015, these subsidies have actually increased. In addition to these national subsidies, multilateral development banks are also providing subsidies for fossil fuels. And again, between 2013 and 2014, we see the African Development Bank, the Asia Development Bank, and the EU Development Bank investing significant amounts in fossil fuel subsidies. Many of these subsidies take the form of tax breaks or other mechanisms to facilitate investments. So for instance, in the case of multilateral development banks, particularly the World Bank and the African Development Bank, these would be subsidies for exploration as well as exploitation of new resources. So for instance, the biggest loan ever made by the World Bank in its history is a loan that was made to the Medupi coal plant in South Africa. So in other words, there are many investments that are being made in fossil fuels. However, while these are the dominant kind of processes within the dominant economic process, they are also countervailing forces. As I said at the beginning, the hegemony is not total. There are, in fact, spaces which are being exploited by other experiments, either at a national or sub-national level. Experiments, explorations of different economic models that can possibly lead us to a future economic system that is more climate-friendly and sustainable. In particular, civil society has attempted to counterbalance the public private sorry, interest by proposing policies that are more democratic. In other words, policies that are more responsive to a public agenda rather than policies that are driven by private sector interests. And in a developed economies, it is interesting to know that a very interesting trend is a trend towards deprivatization and re-municipalization of public utilities. And these are public utilities such as energy, water, transport, and health. What this means is that you remember that in the years of market triumphalism, at the 1980s, the 1990s, and so on, there was a massive move towards the privatization of public utilities in energy, in water, in just about everything you can think about. And this actually resulted in many of the inefficiencies that we are seeing today. In response to those inefficiencies, civil society organizations, municipalities, and other democratic processes have sought to regain control away from the private sector of these utilities In fact, part of the reason why, for instance, California could come out and state that they were not going to abide by the withdrawal from the Paris Agreement is because California is one of the leading states in remunicipalization of public utilities. And this is a trend, I think, that we really need to understand and to study in order to look to understand whether, in fact, we can develop alternative futures based on the democratization of the production process away from its privatization. Now, of course, the defining feature of these deprivatization initiatives is the recovery of public capacity away from private corporations. And this is quite significant in that the control of these public utilities by public policy is responsive to a democratic agenda. So these are the forces that have led the USA to seek to withdraw from the Paris Agreement, and these are the countervailing forces against it. So what are the implications of this for Africa? And I'll state these implications in the form of conclusions. The first is that I think it's self-evident that the world will not be able to avoid climate change if countries continue to rely on fossil fuels for their energy needs. And as I have tried to demonstrate, it is not only the USA which is seeking to increase its fossil fuel consumption. Just about everyone is seeking to increase their fossil fuel consumption. And therefore, investment must shift towards clean alternatives. But there is, in fact, no political imperative to direct investment towards clean towards clean alternatives. Instead, we could argue that most of the investment that is occurring in clean energy is being driven by economic concerns without sufficient political compulsion. And therefore, we can conclude that shifting government support away from fossil fuel production, that is eliminating all incentives for fossil fuels, could actually be an important mechanism to force investment towards greener development processes. However, we should recognize that fossil fuels continue to be a considerable force that has to be reckoned with, and we need to develop strategies and mechanisms of responding to the impact of fossil fuels on public processes. And in this case, I take solace from the fact that the experiences of deprivatization demonstrate that, in fact, it is actually possible to democratize this process. But we really need to ensure that we invest in the capacity of non-state actors, sub-state actors, and other actors to control the future economic pathways that we are going to follow in order to achieve the climate goals. And finally, and I know that I did not in fact address this question, but we really need to address the question of climate justice as part of the climate governance framework. In other words, if we are going to create a binding and achievable climate framework, it has to also resort back to the issue of climate justice based on common but differentiated responsibility. I will stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, James. I think that was very, very useful and several areas that you covered. Before I kind of get into that, I just wanted to recognize the presence of our scientific advisory committee. It's actually quite fortuitous that they're here. At a time when we are talking about climate change and the withdrawal, US withdrawal from the Paris Agreement. Very quickly, the Scientific Advisory Committee, I mean, I believe that it's like a powerhouse. It represents and it constitutes, if you like, the finest intellectual capital that we have in terms of climate science. We have an initiative that we call Climate Research for Development, and this initiative is an initiative whereby we're trying to see how we can narrow the gap between, you know, climate change research and climate information needs. The ultimate objective is to see how we can better support African governments in terms of planning, especially planning around sensitive climate sectors. So I'd just like to recognize the presence of the SAC. We have, as you would soon observe, we have many professors in this scientific advisory committee. Professor Pauline Dieu, who is here somewhere. Yeah, and Professor Richard Anya, I think he just left the room. We've got Professor Kush, Dr. Ashraf, Dr. Ajaye, Olu Ajaye, Dr. Ernest, somewhere, Professor Nuruddin. Okay, we also very honored to have Dr. Joseph Cabana, who is the director of AMCOMED Secretariat. Colleagues, welcome to this event, and I'm sure that you'd also add your contributions to this discussion, which I believe is very important for Africa in terms of how we begin to understand the geopolitics, the economies of Africa, and how we are going to be able to survive climate change and climate impacts, but also what are we going to do in terms of ensuring that what we commit to vis-a-vis climate action is going to be very much aligned with our own aspirations for development, that we're not going to derail our development aspirations if we commit seriously to climate change action. James, we're going to invite Johnson to sort of discuss, but I just wanted to point out that you've made several points which I think are very important. You talked about, I think, something that we all know, but you mentioned the fact that climate change in many ways is indicative of this global hegemonic power that we see, that is already in place, whereby the biggest hegemons do not want to lose their place in the world economy. And those that are somewhat in the periphery also want to gain a place in the world economy. So very much indicative of the hegemonic control of the world economy. You've also talked about the commodification of fossil fuel, and I think that we as a society have not yet been able to replace, since the Industrial Revolution, we have not been able to find another alternative to coal. We talk about renewable energy, but to the extent in which we see just the several wonders, especially following the Industrial Revolution of coal, we've not been able to replace that with anything else, even with the potential and promise of renewable energy technologies. You've talked about the US, but I like the fact that you said, I mean, this is no great revelation in many ways, because the US have already, and in many ways, have stood in the periphery for a long time. In fact, they were almost like the elephant in the room, because I think the negotiations did not go as fast as it should have done, because many countries were trying to bring the US back into the fold. And I think that in a way created a lot of delay as well. But in actual fact, this withdrawal is not a big revelation, because in many ways the US has always been in the withdrawing camp, if you like, for a long time. Another point I think which you mentioned is that, yes, the Paris Agreement has been mentioned as, you know, a success of multilateralism in many ways, but it does have a number of weaknesses, and the non-binding effect that you talked about, the fact that there's no mechanism for enforcement, all of these things are very true about the Paris Agreement. But it's the best thing that we've had in a long time, and I think that's why it's celebrated to the extent that it is. The climate justice aspect, the moral and equity issue that you mentioned in terms of how do you begin to not interrogate a country like the US, who historically is seen as a culprit in terms of emissions, and the production of emissions. How do you begin to say that this somehow is not your concern and therefore you can opt out? And if we are beginning to opt out, can we also ask countries who have nothing to do with this to opt out in terms of climate action? And you've talked about the powerful fossil fuel lobby. In fact, one of the things that I sort of tend to come back to and gravitate towards is that, for me, the best way to address climate change is to go back to the economic model, our model of growth, because that is, to a large extent, the problem and the solution. You know, this is what has generated the kind of environmental mess that we see today, but we also have to go back to the same model of consumption, production of emissions, the economy, as the main sort of entry points in addressing and especially looking at it from a climate capitalism perspective to be able to address the problem. You've also talked about the distinction between Kyoto Protocol and the Paris Agreement in terms of this being a public policy instrument. In many ways, the onus is on the public policy instrument rather than on the market-driven considerations. In fact, many of the market-driven considerations that you've mentioned in terms of the buying and selling of the emissions have failed as far as Africa is concerned. The Clean Development Mechanism is a spectacular case of failure where Africa is concerned. I think the one of the things that I was hoping to hear, which I haven't heard, but maybe Johnson will bring this out, is just the very importance of non-state actors. That to a large extent, the Paris also celebrated the large energy conglomerates that were there, the civil society, the pressure groups, all of these that were providing pressure points to ensure that we are going to sort of end with an agreement that would somehow be one that spells out a collective vision. And I haven't heard much about the role that non-state actors can play. I'm conscious of time and conscious of the fact that Johnson also has to come in with his own contributions. But thanks a lot, James, for the depth of your analysis and the way in which you have looked at this from a very comprehensive perspective, outlining many of the sort of the weaknesses of the Paris Agreement. Johnson, are you going to give us a much more positive spin on this?
Thanks, Fatima. So what I would do to make a discussion is to put some framing and context to what James has presented. By the way, before we start, let's look at exactly what did President Trump say when he was pulling America out. He said it is important to recall the fact that in his speech announcing the withdrawal, President Trump emphasized that, in quote, "to fulfill my solemn duty to protect America and its citizens, the United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord, but begin negotiations to re-enter our ways into Paris Accord by entering into an entire new transaction or terms that are fair to the United States, its businesses, its workers, its people, and its taxes." So that is, it sounds like a political statement, but that has significant implications both in the United States as well as globally. I mean, one of the withdrawal itself signifies a lot of things, as Jim highlighted in his speech, but there are many different perspectives you can look at this withdrawal based on each particular interest, because this is a revelation of an interest-based system that predominates how we conduct multilateral transactions. As you see very clearly, some of the immediate implications, as James highlighted in his speech, is that America is a big emitter, both historically and currently, because even though China is second, it doesn't mean America's emission has changed. So the withdrawal alone signifies that the accountability, means of accountability and responsibility for the emission have been lost by the global community, not in the sense of sanction, but even in tracking what they're doing. So there's a lot of huge political implication on this particular issue. Again, when you look at the global goal, as Fatima said in his opening remark, the whole Paris Agreement is framed as trying to achieve 2 degrees or less, probably 1.5. But if one of the major emitters moves out of the room, definitely, it's clear that that target is not going to be achieved, whether we like it or not. Although the American people themselves, from a more the construct of the Paris Agreement allows for other actors beyond just political actors to play in. The willingness among the American people is quite high and quite visible. I mean, those who observe Hurricane Harvey will notice that the people acted autonomously. That is kind of the energy that people think they should act and push back. However, there is a great implication which we cannot undermine the political issue. In fact, this particular domestic crusade of dismantling the whole Paris Agreement was expressed yesterday when the head of the Environmental Protection Agency said that he will sign a new rule overriding the Clean Power Plan put in place during the Obama's era, an effort to limit carbon emissions from coal-fired power plants. Similarly, 2 weeks ago, before the Hurricane Harvey, President Trump also overturned his predecessor's flood risk standards, which was meant to be like a resilience tool to address climate change among communities. So that again tells you that this is not an easy game. There is a lot of implications to what President Trump did, which we cannot ignore. One perspective we should look at it is, what does the U.S. withdrawal mean for the Paris Agreement itself, the agreement itself? Because James have given us a very in-depth nature of the agreement, the instrument, the composition, and what how it plays in transition from Kyoto. But then when you look at the Paris Agreement, from what Fatima said, and I wrote it down, the Paris Agreement provided a direction of travel. The question then is, are we still in the same direction when Trump moves out of it? That's a very important thing, because he carries alone a huge percentage of emissions out of that travel direction. James has really highlighted the whole framework of multilateral systems and processes. However, by Trump moving away from collectivism embodied in the spirit of negotiation back to individualism, the pretext of national interest prevails over common goods or public goods, as he tried to put it. At the end of the day, he is drawing the concern of a national good. He looks at his national interest more than the common good, which is the atmosphere. This only reconfirms the hidden fear of some people and the mistrust that people have had all along about some of the elements of the negotiation. The withdrawal simply exposes the fragility of the Paris Agreement. We cannot undermine this, you know. The inability to deliver of its outcome is quite obvious now, whether we like it or not. I mean, because a lot of metrics have been put on 2 degrees. If you look at the adaptation goal, it's based on a 2-degree target. And if you move it beyond 2 degrees, the global goal for adaptation is lost. Even the financing element of $100 billion per year, all of those things are metric on a temperature scale, which means once we go beyond that threshold, the whole dynamic changes. Trump, one of the other things that has generated a major problem within the agreement, from my view, is that Trump has tampered with the framework of science informing the negotiation process. He has casted a lot of doubts on the science, so that it weakens the whole science policy interface, which will be struggling over the years to mainstream climate change into policy using science-based information. This has been severely weakened in a way that it would need a lot of effort. I mean, there are countries now whereby even if their leaders don't voice it out, to convince them will need an additional work to catch up with all of that. I'm mindful of time. Let's go straight to what are the direct implications for Africa, another frame we can open up the discussion. With the obvious inability to achieve the global goal, which from the Paris Agreement is supposed to be 2 degrees, it is certain that it will lead to further amplification of Africa's risk to climate change. I mean, we saw what happened in Sierra Leone. Just a heavy intensity of rainfall caused a massive landslide that killed a lot of people. So this is going to be more intensified, as we know from the science, following the continuous pollution that Mr. Trump has generated. So it is unfortunate that Africa's burden, as Fatima said from the beginning, will continue to increase. And part of that, again, goes back to our development. We give South a very low adaptive capacity. UNEP had put in the adaptation gap report that Africa cost for adaptation will be about $50 billion per year by 2050, provided we stay below 2 degrees. However, this was going to double to at least $100 billion if we don't achieve 2 degrees. So where will Africa be? The question you should ask that, should Africa consider pursuing a development first, like Mr. Trump said about America, in order to build resilience? Or should we also stay in loyalty to the agreement? The dropout, in my view, locks Africa in a position of inflexibility in its choices for climate solutions. This is a very important point because before, part of the solution was dependent on the reduction of the temperature. And that required a huge mitigation that involved America. And if we don't have clear indication of achieving that, it means our choices are not flexible anymore. We have to think more strategically how we deal with this issue. This leaves Africa in a very confounding situation. The hard lesson is that's obvious now for Africa. We have to pursue vigorously climate resilient development that will better deal with future climate risks beyond just adaptation. There is a huge difference between adaptation and climate resilience. Usually, we used to negotiate on trying to adapt to climate change, but now we need more than adaptation. So the whole sense of climate resilience should be our underlying factors. Again, the Paris Agreement is not a complete failure. There are opportunities, as Fatima said, and Jim said it in his presentation, with regards to the NDC. We have an opportunity to use the NDC to realign our national development towards providing the kind of crucial orientation needed to making the transition to low carbon development and climate resilience, to improve our climate resilience. Before I stop, I would like to come back to one of the points Jen made about fuel subsidies, whereby he indicated that subsidies by USA and other OECD countries is still continuing. This is true, but it's not unique to those countries. Even Africa is subsidizing heavily. And some of the records we have show that about 2 to 3, between 1.5 to 2% of the GDP of African countries in average is used for fuel subsidies, which is more than their healthcare budget of an average of 1.2. So it's not an externalized issue that we should deal with. They should deal with subsidies when we don't deal with it locally. So I end here, Chair. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Johnson. I guess it's another set of very powerful points that you've put. Why are we getting this? Okay. Johnson, this is actually quite a revelation to me, this aspect of the US now, because they're out, that we somehow missing out on the whole aspect of accountability. I've never seen it from that perspective, because I guess we were very much against the free riding effect, that this should not be one where people free ride. And I think, yes, there is a lot of sense in that, that we're not going to be able to account for, you know, what the US is doing or not doing in terms of climate action, because they're not in it. But then again, James did mention, you know, states like California that are doing quite a lot already. So I guess that somehow it doesn't quite balance it out, but it's it also is an argument that we have to take into account. So we don't have enough time for questions and answers, but I would like to turn the discussion to the floor to allow you as audience, and you've been listening to all of us talk for a long time, to give us a sense of, you know, what's your take in all of this? I mean, I think we haven't, to the extent that I thought we would have done, really, you know, shined a spotlight on Africa. I think I'm missing that part. If I were somebody who is a layperson and doesn't quite understand what climate change is, one question I would be asking you and James is, you know, yes, the US has withdrawn from the Paris Agreement, but why should we care? You know, what does this mean for Africa? Why should we care? I'd also like to very quickly look at the members of the SAC and see whether they've got any words of wisdom to offer at this point in time, or whether you'd want to see how the discussions evolve and then come in with your points, if any. But the opportunity, yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Duncan. When I saw this topic, I told Prof. Anya that some two months ago, I had to present almost the same topic in Finland. But I was talking about another aspect. The US is pulling out from the Paris Agreement. Where is it going? What is the alternative that the US is proposing to the world? You talked about energy efficiency mechanisms, but I'm talking about something else. From America, some American scientists, especially engineers, the problem is not really the emission that we're emitting today. The problem is those emissions that have been there in the atmosphere, and how to pull them out. That will take millennia. So they said, okay, there's another way we can do it. We can use engineering methods for us to cool the planet. And Trump took that as his horse. And he's funding that. Last time he funded $20 million to Harvard and American universities to do research on geoengineering. And what would be the consequence of that? That's what I'm talking about. That will have very tremendous consequences on Africa. And you know, Africa is not just one country. It's a continent that is very wide. And the consequences will be different from one region to another one. So I'm not coming to make another speech here. But I'm telling you that consequences may be varied, and for some regions it will be very tremendous. We don't know what may happen. And let's leave it from there, but we can think about that next time, when we can have another discussion on this, and look at this on different perspectives. The positive, negative, and what are also the unexpected outcomes of this withdrawal of America from the Paris Agreement. Thank you.
Any other comments from the SAC? Yeah.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and James. Just one comment I want to make is about the issue of science policy linkage. There used to be this perception or belief that when you get the science right, you fit the facts and you can help to make informed decisions. Well, it's very clear now that the political decision making is embedded in political processes and in power structures. One comment I want to make is for Africa, for the perspective of Africa, I think it's high time we also have to start looking at this understanding the political processes and the power structures. Because it's clear that with all the data and all the facts that were at the disposal of the US government, some very few, you may say there are few, now numbers, but because they know the kind of system and the processes, they were able to exploit this and they got their way out. So maybe it's sometimes that we have to also look at our sciences within this bigger context of political processes. Thank you.
Dr. Mukabana?
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, I come from the World Meteorological Organization, director of the African Regional Office. So all the national meteorological and hydrological services in Africa under me. We were very shocked to hear that the U.S. Is thinking of withdrawing from the Paris Agreement. Reasons are, U.S. has some of the best scientists in the world in terms of climate science. And you can remember that Al Gore got a Nobel Prize on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So the U.S. was very high up there in terms of climate change, the impacts of climate change on the ecosystems, on the environment, on people's livelihoods. And yet, I think the reasons which were put forward for Trump to move out must have been more economic and employment than the reasons of science itself. Because science is very clear. And if you can count the number of tropical cyclones that are now moving into the U.S., like telling them that there's climate change, the intensity of this tropical cyclone has increased. And the intensity of rainfall is also increased. So this to show that climate change is not a joke, but is a reality that's happening. And yet they withdrew because of the politics and because of the economy. They want to use the coal that is there to employ people. So what can happen, what should happen to Africa? I don't think that although Africa is the most vulnerable to vagaries of climate change, that we should also follow the same way. I think we should go the clean way, so that the clean way is now technology is going up. People are going to use the solar and wind power, and probably at some point in time, we'll discover something that is not fuel, depend on the use of fuel. In that case, probably we'll save the environment. Because if we go at the same level, the atmosphere is one. When the pollution increases, all of us suffer, including Africa, which is the least polluter, and yet the most suffering. So we should go the clean way to ensure that at some point the world will be better. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mukabana. Just a second, I've got Professor Pauline Dubay, who also wants to make an intervention. I mispronounced your name earlier, so I'm trying to compensate.
Madam Fatima, and thank you to James and to Johnson. I'll kind of pose questions, because really what came out from James is that the fact that the U.S. has withdrawn, it shows an element of being brave or being honest. Because from the picture he gave, the whole world is not really doing much to address the issue of climate change. But the rest of us, we are saying we are trying to do something. And the U.S. is saying, we know we are not doing much, and they're coming out clean and open. They're being transparent, because what he said is that all of us are going the direction of fossil fuels, even in the developing world. So that is why I like the question which you're saying, the U.S. has pulled out, so what? How does it matter? Because in any case, the globally we are not doing adequately. But I'm involved in the IPCC special report on trying to keep the world at 1.5 warming, not to exceed the 2 degrees, in the context of sustainable development and poverty eradication. And from this talk, and I'm thinking, so why are we doing this report? So I wanted to ask James whether this report is still relevant at all. Will it help the world at all? And then I'm also thinking that the world came together not so long to talk about sustainable development goals. And you wonder whether what is there? How will we be able to achieve all these aspirations that we have? And we, the momentum, the amount of energy we put in coming out with all these, what is it for? Because with the global warming continuing, it's difficult to see how we get to achieve those. I'd like to hear some comments in relation to that. But the other thing that the world is, the scientists are saying is that we have entered a different a world where humanity now is the main driver of all the physical processes, you know, where we change the how the planet Earth functions, which now people call the Anthropocene. And so they're saying perhaps we need to be learning how to live within the Anthropocene and not thinking that we can move backwards and clean up all the carbon that we're putting there. Although there's a question mark since the warming itself is continuing, so I'll be glad to hear from the speakers what they think about if we were to accept that we have changed the planet Earth and its processes, and we need to learn to live within this new world that we have created. So I'll leave it to that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor. So I'll turn to you, the gentleman. Yes, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Wilkin Adegafu. I come from the Ethiopian Meteorological Society. I heard that who cares about the United States if it withdraws? I don't know whether really we should adopt that attitude, because earlier you mentioned, Fatima, yourself, that from many angles, the United States, first, it is the largest emitter, and leaving alone or reaching through the United States will have a lot of implication, because it's the largest emitter. Secondly, it has financial assistance, financial aid, financial support for climate-related activities. And the third is there, the ones where technology is very advanced. So I don't think we can afford really to ignore the United States. I think my view is the strategy should be to try to bring the United States back to the agreement by all means. I mean, over 190 nations cannot pressurize the United States, really. One country, it has economic powers, obviously. Like North Korea is sending this thing, they put at the Security Council resolution to sanctions and things like that. So, can't we use different forums? United Nations is a forum, the Security Council is a forum, other forums where we can come together, all nations come together and pressurize the United States. Isn't that a good strategy to follow? Secondly, I think somebody mentioned about the scientific community in the United States. What is this climate? Trump is always a climate skeptic. So it's very difficult. Although he understands, I'm definitely sure he knows about climate change, he understands the implication, but again, it is the economic and the politics and things like that. So in the scientific discussions, different forums, the American scientific community should be able to put pressure on them. The scientific community of Africans, Asians, Europeans should put pressure on the American scientific community to convince Trump. This should be an approach. The third is using the civil society. I mean, you know, there are so many climate-related civil societies. Through them, we should be able to change the American or inform the American public to really pressurize the American government. I mean, my sense is that aside from all measures that would be taken, it's better to, our strategy should be really to bring back the United States during various methods and means, because you can't afford really to ignore the United States. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So just to put a question out there, maybe to intercept the question that Pauline asked and the question that the gentleman from the Ethiopian Met Society asked, is this a sign of honesty, of transparency, as Pauline was saying, with the US deciding to take this move, which is a major move, and does it actually translate a bigger problem that's out there that we as a society have not been able to wean ourselves off fossil fuel consumption? And should we, I guess another way of looking at it based on the last intervention is that should we now channel all our energies in getting the US as this major emitter, major player, you know, that has a moral imperative to do something about this problem? Should we now channel all our energies into getting the US back into the fold? You know, where should we sit, you know, between admitting that, yes, we have a problem in terms of consumption and production, and fossil fuel is a problem, or should we now say, well, it is a problem, but we cannot address the problem without the major players, and U.S. Undeniably is a major player. I see Linus, there's a lady down there, maybe who can take three or four interventions, Louis and the gentleman over here, so we could start with those four in that particular order.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the...
Can you keep your intervention short, because we are out of time, actually, okay. 6 minutes ago.
Yeah, I'll keep them short, but I just want to, just from another point of view for reflection, you know, James clearly elaborated that the Paris Agreement was based on the bottom-up voluntary contribution, and it is non-binding. Therefore, why would America want to make a big statement that they are pulling out of it, knowing that you could have stayed in the Paris Agreement, not achieve anything, and knowing that nothing will happen to you? So I think this is the crux of it, and it goes back to the issue of interest. And the issue of interest is the fact that, as we speak, America is investing a huge amount of money in carbon capture and storage, and carbon capture and use. And they feel that this is how you have to develop a system, Madam Chair, that it is about your economy. So America knows that they have to develop in this area, and so they want to focus on carbon capture, storage, and use. And therefore, because they didn't have to pull out of the Paris Agreement, since they voluntarily gave what they said they will do, nobody told them what to do. And that is why everybody went from Kyoto to this, because America, nobody tells America what to do. So now we had a situation where America said to the world, this is what we will do in terms of our commitment. Nobody is going to come and police you into doing it. Then you have to make a big statement that you're pulling out. So it is because of some other reason, and that other reason is because America has more interest in developing into this area of carbon capture, storage, and use. And also, Madam Chair, I think for the context of Africa, it is very wrong for us to be using this narrative that we have to pull away from fossil fuels, because the issue is not an issue of fuel, it's an issue of emission. And we know technology is changing, and so on. So we should focus more on issue on emission and talk less about the fuel, because the fuel is not the issue is the emission. And there are cleaner coal products, cleaner coal technologies, for example. There are new technologies that come that make even the use of coal, the use of gas, even cleaner. So I would propose that we focus more on promoting a narrative of low carbon emission in Africa than that.
But isn't the fuel part of the emission? I mean, isn't that part of the same logic?
It's a logic, but
you can't have emissions if you don't have fuel.
Yeah, but political and the political economy comes, and also the fact that you can use better technologies to reduce the emissions from the same fuel. And we don't know what disruptive innovations are around the corner. And therefore, if something happens that you can actually burn coal to a super, super efficient way, then you are knocked out because you are not. So I think it's good to focus on the emissions narrative than the fuel narrative.
Focusing on the emissions narrative, the lady at the extreme end.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and the presenters. My name is Margaret Oduk from United Nations Environment Programme, based here in Addis. And thank you for this very insightful discussion. I just wanted to make it short and ask the presenters, I quite didn't get, you know, what is in it for Africa? Because we are debating around the table a lot about the U.S. pulling out of the Paris Agreement. We have the meeting coming up sometime next month, the agreement meeting coming up. What can you say, you know, African governments expect from the meeting in the advent of this pulling out of the U.S.? What do we have to say for that one? And also, if you can maybe later on, or informally or bilaterally, just make me understand more, where does Africa, what's the way forward for Africa? How do we handle this politically and, in a policy context and everything that goes with it? Because we have also sustainable development we're looking at. How does this all link for Africa? And I think with that, then it will help us also understand the implications, really, what the presentation is supposed to give us, the implication of the U.S. pulling out of the agreement and its impact on, you know, African issues. Thank you.
Thank you. So, Klee, definitely a very pointed question about how do we bring this back to Africa, you know, as the sort of center of gravity. Louis?
Yeah, I have 2 points here. The first one is a reaction to Prof. I forgot your name. He proposed that we should make effort to, we should put pressure on the U.S. to bring it back. The direct reaction here is that I think the Paris Agreement itself, it allows any country to pull out whenever it wants. If you read Article 28, it is very clear the U.S. has the right to pull out. Today it's the U.S., tomorrow it might be China or Britain or another country. So it's sad, but the Paris Agreement itself allows that. And I don't think that putting pressure on the U.S. will be, I think it will be contrary to the spirit of Paris Agreement, because it gives member states, it respects the sovereignty of member states. So the second point is, James, in your conclusion, I did not see the mention or reference to market mechanisms, and yet these are the first best in reducing greenhouse gases emissions. I suspect that you did this, I mean, you omitted them because of their failure in Africa, but they have success elsewhere, in Alberta, in California. China is now using for carbon taxes. So what if we find out the reasons for that failure and correct those failures and apply them to Africa? Would that be a viable solution to develop technology and other means of increasing energy efficiency? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Louis. Yes.
Bertrand Lassessant from the Embassy of France. Thank you for this very interesting presentation. I just want to stress one thing, is that the presenter stressed very correctly that economic interest sometimes plays against the interest of the planet, but sometimes it can also play in favor of the planet. And the role of public policy is to make sure that the economic interest plays in favor of the planet, because low carbon transition is already here. In certain countries, renewable energies are already cheaper than oil, than coal, than gas. And I think all the, well, the big question is how we make sure that all public policies enable the economic interest to place in favor of the planet. And I hope, I think as France, as the European Union, we hope that the U.S. realize that it's also in their own economic interest to play in favor of the planet. The renewable energies are already creating more jobs than coal energy does in the U.S. So we hope that in the future they are going to realize this, and that we can all work together in order to make the planet great again. Thank you.
I like that,
huh? That
end,
make
the planet great.
It's from my president.
I know, but it's still a catchy sense to it. Okay, so, the lady at the back.
Thank you. My name is Zoe. I'm from the U.S. mission to the EU. No pressure. I feel I'm amongst friends. I just wanted to reiterate, not a lot of people are going to like this, but we maintain our intent to withdraw from the Paris Agreement. The reasons are well known, and there's been a lot of discussion about that today. But just to made the official statement once again. Our president, President Trump, believes that the current terms of the agreement are not favorable to our country. But at the same time, I'm glad we talked a little bit about clean energy, renewable energy, because I also want to reiterate that the United States does believe in a balanced approach to climate policy that lowers emissions while at the same time promoting economic growth, competitiveness, and ensuring energy security. So we will continue to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions through innovation and technological breakthroughs. And we will continue to work with other countries, to help other countries use fossil fuels more cleanly and efficiently, and deploy renewable and other clean energy sources, given the importance of energy access and security in many of the NDCs. The State Department, which is where I'm from, is working currently with the White House to develop a more comprehensive climate policy. And we hope to reveal it very soon, and we look forward to working with all our allies, all our partners, and everyone else to seek common ground and definitely to develop a way forward on this very important issue. Thanks.
Thank you very much. So James, over to you, and Johnson, just to give you your sort of conclusions on this. I just wanted to point out one point I think that was mentioned in this in the interventions. I read somewhere that developing countries' investment in renewable, excluding large hydro projects, is more or less surpassed the same investments that are made by developed countries. So I mean that's a major shift, you know. And I think another big shift that we're seeing is that we have literally been able to transform the narrative from the narrative of gloom to a narrative of opportunity. And I think now that we are talking about the narrative of opportunity, and we're talking about the fact that many renewable energy technologies are coming down in price, one point which I haven't heard is this aspect of technological breakthrough. You know, Professor Kush talked about geoengineering, which for some people is a definite no-no, you know. But what is the role of technology, especially in a continent where, you know, we have been somewhat, you know, seen as technological laggards? What's the role of technology in advancing in sort of playing a big role in climate action? How can technology help shift this balance that we're talking about?
Yeah. Firstly, I think that there's been a rich conversation, and a lot of significant observations have been made in terms of the implications for Africa, the need to focus on the balance between political and economic interests and so on. But coming to this question of technology, I agree completely that there have been quite significant advances in the technology. Away from emissions or emissions intensive technologies. And probably these are in fact not recent advances. These are actually advances that have been made ages ago. But there's a reason that why these have not been mainstreamed into economic processes. And this reason is the same reason that the current dominant economic processes are not interested. Right? In other words, I think Linus, for instance, talks about the need to focus on reducing the carbon intensity of fuels than the emissions themselves. But if you look at, for instance, the current investments of the World Bank in developing countries, it is not on reducing the intensity of carbon in emissions. It is actually in increasing exploitation of carbon fossil fuels. In other words, there is a domination of economic interest in continuing to exploit. I mean, for instance, the electric car could have been invented many years ago, but there's been well-known resistance to this invention. So the point I'm making, Fatima, is science is not value-free at all. The funding for science, the direction of science and so on, are actually responses to dominant economic forces. So let us, the question that I was posed about where are we going to go with this in the Paris Agreement. My own perspective is we need to insist that the Paris Agreement begins to develop mechanisms that enable it to compel nations and economies to behave in certain ways.
This is to say there should be a reduction of incentives for fossil fuels and an increase in incentives either for efficiency or for other alternative fuels. Without that change in incentives, I don't think that we are going to achieve any of the objectives of the agreement. Thank you.
Johnson?
Thanks, Chair. I mean, just to respond to a colleague from UNEP, what is the need for, I mean, what is the interest for Africa going forward? For me, I look at it as an element of means of implementation. If we need to get the agreement works for Africa, we need to find ways of ensuring means of implementation that comprises the technology you talk about, the skill sets in terms of capacity, and also finances. Yes, we will not always depend on international means of financing, but it will be a slow win process, win people off from dependency. Then lastly, to the point Pauline raised, shouldn't we be thinking on how to adapt to a hotter world? Let's put it that way. I mean, before, people never thought that anyone could survive in Antarctica. But today, people go there for tourism. So perhaps it's a new thinking that we should start also looking at that scientific aspect. Yes, it's not like we are ignoring that the world is warming up, but at least to think more broadly and spread our research to address some of those issues that can provide alternatives. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Impossible to sort of wrap up because I think this has been a very rich set of discussions that we've had today. I've often used the analogy to say that 54 countries from Africa, if we were during the Paris COP21, if we were to sort of walk out of it, then there probably would not be an agreement in terms of what we know today. So I think Professor Kush was saying Africa is not one country, it's a whole continent. And I think this is something that we need to bear in mind, that there are so many different interests as well, even within Africa and across different parts of Africa. But again, coming back to something that Pauline said, you know, we have to prepare ourselves to enter into a different world. This is a world where we do not have a manual that tells us how we're going to behave. It's warming, unprecedented warming that we've never seen before. So it means, as I said before, that we have to become more astute in terms of how we're going to somehow reduce emissions. It's been said that the best way for emissions to reduce is if we get into some kind of a depression. That when economies contract, that's the only way, massive way, that we can begin to reduce emissions. Yet I think the one dilemma, or at least the one constant, is that people do, or economies do, want to grow, even as they reduce emissions. So I think that's something that we're going to have to get clever at. How do we continue to grow and then continue to reduce our emissions at the same time? You know, and that's the kind of massive transformation and radical behavioral change that we need to put in place. And that, I think, is what we need to get better at. It's not about our policies, new policies. We might have new policies, but it's about how fast we're going to be able to move to really be able to achieve this radical transformation that will basically dislodge the fossil fuel industry that we see now, and that forms the backbone of many of our economies. So with that, I'd like to thank you all for coming. I hope we can have these kind of discussions more frequently as part of our seminar series. It helps us to dive into it, but it creates also a safe space, and I hope even with the US in the room, it is still a safe place to have an intellectual discussion. So thanks again for your attendance and participation. Thank you. Thanks to James and to Johnson for ably putting all their points through. Thank you.